The sermon this morning is going to be in 1 Corinthians chapter 4. We continue our study of Paul's first letter to the Corinthian church. We're going to start up today at chapter 4, verse 1. Paul takes the opportunity this morning to bring their attention to a related matter that is directly connected to his appeal for unity that we just finished. Remember, as we look forward into this chapter, that Paul considers these Corinthians to be believers. Even though the Corinthian culture had crept into the church, even though we're going to find as we go through Corinthians, there are so many different sin areas and struggles that they had. He calls them natural in the way that they're acting, immature. And so what he's hoping to do is draw them spiritually to maturity. That first appeal for unity sprang from their fighting over which leader were they loyal to. Some were loyal to Apollo, some were loyal to Paul, some were loyal to Peter, and they had taken ownership of these servants that God had given to the church. This one's mine. I will only listen to him. And Paul identifies this as carnality. He says it's worldly thinking. And he says this worldly thinking is the core issue that's at the core of several of the problems across this Corinthian church. He wants them to understand who these servants of God are. Remember, he says that they're workers, they're servants, they're planters, they're waterers, they're builders, laborers. But he reminds us in each of those that God owns the fields, God owns the building, God owns the harvest, and God is the foundation. So stop boasting in men. Stop trusting in men. Stop fighting and quarreling over men. All of them have been given to you. All things are yours. And you are Christ's. And they are Christ's. And Christ is God's. You're unified. You should be one in him. And so we come to this next section of the letter, chapter 4. And Paul takes a moment to close out some of these areas that he opened in that first appeal, these areas that were affecting their lack of growth, this idea of carnality, their lack of unity. Remember in the last chapter, the last section, Paul pushes them. He says, stop being merely human. You place these men on pedestals. You know what that term means? You put those heads on a pedestal. That's what the Romans did with the gods, right? They would put their heads, their busts on pedestals and worship them. And he says, you're placing these servants of Christ on pedestals. No, these men were given to the church. And then he points out to them exactly why they have such a hard time thinking of them this way. As we find, as we move through chapter 4, he starts to get more specific and more specific and more specific. And what he's leading to is the reason that you think this way, the reason that you think you have the ability to judge who is a good leader and who is a bad one, why someone is great and you only follow him, and why someone's bad and you won't even listen to him, is your arrogance. It's your conceit. It's your pride. You want them to be great because if they're great and you follow them by default, you are great. So he admonishes them. And he ends this chapter 4 with a very fatherly exhortation. And so that's what we're about to see over the next 2 weeks. So the last section ended with verses 22 and 23 of chapter 3. Whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or the present or the future, all are yours. And you are Christ's and Christ is God's. All these things are yours. And so the question is, how did you get to this point where you're fighting with each other over whose is the best? How did you get there? I want you to understand this morning as we begin this message, it's not too hard to figure out. We do it all the time. Think about these questions. Who is your favorite pastor or teacher? You all have one, or two, or three. Why is he so great? You ever get into an argument with somebody else about why yours is better than theirs? Where is the very best church? Where does it exist? Which is the one? Don't we get into discussions about that? What makes it best? And if we're honest with each other, we would admit that our evaluation criteria is based on what? It's usually based on worldly wisdom. What suits our tastes? What we desire? What we value? What we think is right? Here's what most people look at. How many attend that church? Where is that pastor invited to speak? How many books has he written? Where is his education from? How beautiful are his sermons, really? How culturally relevant is he to the folks around? What do my heroes say about him? We look at these for our judgment, don't we? Is he big on evangelism? Is he big on counseling? Because I'm big on counseling. I want him to be big on counseling. Is he big on exposition, Bible exposition? And so we make some sort of evaluation. Paul, as he talks about it, we open up the words, it's criticism. And so we criticize. We almost make it a sport of criticizing other workers, other churches, other ministries. Don't we? How often do we get together as Christians and speak critically of other churches, other works, other pastors? Why? Because we think somehow by lowering them, we're raising ours. It's very natural thinking. It's very worldly in the way in which we do that. So we come to 1 Corinthians 4. What happens is Paul's now going to tell them and us, right? He tells them, I don't want you thinking of Christ's servants. I don't want you thinking in this way. I don't want you to be lifting them high. I don't want you to be worshiping the servants of Christ. You've got to stop. So chapter 4, verse 1, he starts, he goes, this is how I want you to think about my servants that I send to the church. This is how I want you to regard them. Chapter 4. Look at how it begins. This is how one should regard us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. We're not going to get very far because we're going to open that up a little bit this morning. He takes their attention on the true nature and the marks of God's servants. He wants people, if you have a King James version, if you're using King James, it says, how would you account your servants? That's the word that's used, account. It's an interesting word, right? It's a financial term. It's before we look at this further, I want you to understand the term seems to indicate a ledger. You've been given an asset. How do you account it into your portfolio? Right? Do you start to think, how often do you think of that as your servants, your preachers, your teachers, those that have been given to the church, as an asset of the church, and how do we account for them? How do we account them in? It almost makes them seem like property. It takes them lower, doesn't it? He wants you to see it that way. It reads, let a man account for us. Or some of your versions might say, let us reckon a man. Whatever term you're comfortable with, account, reckon, regard. The word is used by Paul again in Romans 8:36. Romans 8, verse 36. As it is written, for your sake we are being killed all the day long. We are regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. The word therefore regarded, right? What he's saying is, how do the Roman officials account for the Christians? Right? The Christians are a part of our people. And so the Romans that were in leadership are looking at the Christians and they're saying, what value are they? What are they good for? How do we regard this people that is a people of our possession? And what are they good for? The Romans say, sheep to be slaughtered. That was their accounting of Christians in that day. That's how they saw, that's how they evaluated the Christian. Another place is 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy chapter 4. 2 Timothy 4, verses 14 to 16. Alexander the coppersmith did me great harm. The Lord will repay him according to his deeds. Beware of him yourself, for he strongly opposed our message. At my first defense, no one came to stand by me, but all deserted me. May it not be charged or accounted, reckoned against them. What's Paul saying there? He was harmed by Alexander, and none of the church, none of the folks who should have stood by him, stood by him. And what he wanted is, he says, when you account them, when you look at them, I don't want you to look at them with that to their charge. Don't add that to their valuation. Last one, 1 Corinthians, going back to 1 Corinthians 13, verse 5. We're in the love chapter. And he says, I'll start with four. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. Isn't that weird? That word resentful is the same word that's used here. The actual Greek is reckon not for evil. What does that mean? It means to thinketh not evil. That's what it really says, to thinketh not evil. We use that a lot when we're doing marriage counseling, don't we? And that is, when a husband and wife is together, what you want to make sure is that you're not assigning intent. You're not assigning motives to the other person. That's what that's saying. You're going to think the best of them. You're going to consider that their motives are good. Their execution might be poor. But we trust always, right? When we love someone, that their motives are pure. That's how we value someone. That's how we look at someone with love. And so all of these I want to bring out for you because I want you to understand what Paul's saying. He says, this is how I want you to reckon, regard, account. This is how I want you to thinketh about my servants. These preachers, these teachers, these servants, these Sunday school teachers, all of these that are serving you. This is how I want you to picture them and to value them and to account for them. And so, he says what? This is how you should regard us. And he gives you two pictures. Servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. To us, we're like, okay, we've heard that a lot of times in sermons. Many of us have been Christians for a long time. We understand this idea of servants, but maybe not so much. When we get into the Greek, he's very clear. He and Luke both use this particular term for servants in this particular place. Huperaitis. It means under rowers. You know what an under rower is? It's great. At the old Roman ships, remember you picture the old Roman ships, and they had the galley slaves. And they had two sets of rowers. The ones on the top deck. You've seen the pictures, right, with all of the oars going at once, but there was also a bottom deck. And the bottom deck is where you put the lowest of the galley slaves. And they were down below, sweaty, musty, hot. It was the least desired. If you were going to be a slave, that was the one slave job you did not want to get. It was horrible down there. Your whole entire life was spent doing what? Listening for the drum cadence. Because your whole livelihood, whether or not you got a beating for the day, whether or not you got fed or not, was predicated on the fact, did you stroke and draw the oars to the beat in perfect unison with all of the other galley lower oarsmen? You're anonymous down there. It's hard to move up because anyone who would show and say, I'm going to be stronger than the rest. What would happen? He would tangle up the oars and cause the ship to go off kilter, and he'd been beaten or put overboard. And so the whole trick of being an under galley, right, a lower galley slave, was to watch the other servants around you to make sure that you were drawing with the exact same strength, you were drawing to the exact same rhythm, and that you were all taking orders from the exact same master. That's the first picture. When you think of those that are servants of Christ, the first picture I want you to see is I want you to think lower rowers, galley slaves, who listen for the drum cadence, who take orders from one master. They're anonymous. It's not pleasant work. And then, stewards of the mysteries of God. Stewards. What was a steward's servant? It was a house manager. They were the ones who distributed and managed the property and the fields, the vineyards, the finances of the master's household. Remember in the story of Joseph, Joseph was a house steward in Potiphar's house for a while. The steward has one thing to remember, and he's never to make a mistake about it. You know what the one rule that a steward needs to make and always remember? The property he manages is not his own. Think about it. Day in and day out, you're making all of the decisions, you're moving these things around, and you're doing it all under the authority and the direction of the master. Do you know what the propensity is? Is a lot of things that would break a steward was, after a while, they start thinking of the things as their own. No. They never make that mistake. They're always managing the goods of the master. The house steward has one master, the owner, and that owner instructs him how his property is to be managed. Colossians 3:23 says, "Whatever you do, do it heartily, as to the Lord and not unto man." The idea is that the steward had better not deviate from the master's instruction. You can go through the scriptures and find many parables and texts in the Bible that bear this out in numerous ways. In the end, all of those parables about stewards comes back to one or two items, and that is, these stewards are trusted to manage the master's things as they serve only his purposes. Paul wants us to regard the workers, these men that he's gifted to the church, as galley slaves and house stewards. And not yours, his. Do you see that? And they belong to their master, not you. They've been given to serve you, but this is the direction of him. They're not above it all. They're below it all. That's the picture that Paul is painting for them. And I want you to look at Paul's expectation of God's workers that he gives to the church. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Chapter 6, verses 4 to 13. He gives you a picture of what to expect. "But as servants of God, we commend ourselves in every way, by great endurance, in afflictions, hardships, calamities, beatings, imprisonments, riots, labors, sleepless nights, hunger, by purity, knowledge, patience, kindness, the Holy Spirit, and genuine love, by truthful speech and the power of God, with the weapons of righteousness for the right hand and for the left, through honor and dishonor, through slander and praise, we are treated as impostors and yet are true, as unknown and yet well known, as dying and behold we live, as punished and yet not killed, as sorrowful yet always rejoicing, as poor yet making many rich, as having nothing yet possessing everything. We've spoken freely to you, Corinthians. Our heart is wide open. You are not restricted by us. You are restricted in your own affections. In return, I speak as to children, widen your hearts also." How does Paul, what's his expectation of the workers of the Lord, these servants of Christ? They endure afflictions, hardships, calamities, beatings, imprisonments, riots, labors, sleepless nights and hunger. They're going to experience dishonor, slander. They're going to be treated as imposters. They're unknown. They're punished. They're sorrowful. They're poor. And they have nothing. We don't want that. Don't you fight against that? Is that how you want our pastors, our teachers, our servants considered? It goes against what we think we want. We want celebrities. We want men of great renown. We want power. We want strength. What does that sound like? Doesn't it sound like Israel when Christ came, doesn't it? We don't want you. You're weak. You came to serve. We want someone who's going to come victorious. We want someone who's going to restore the land. We want someone who's going to be king. Not someone born in a stable. Certainly not someone going to die on a cross. That same nature, that same problem invades the church, doesn't it? We don't like the idea that as we rise, as we're called to ministry, we're called to this. Galley slaves and house stewards, God's fellow workers, stewards of Christ. Verse 2, moreover, it's required of stewards that they be found trustworthy. These are stewards, and what are they in charge of? They're in charge of the mysteries of God. We've come to understand from Corinthians earlier on, what's the mysteries of God he's talking about? He's talking about the gospel. So the first rule, remember, as the steward, the master's property does not belong to you, which means you better not be messing with the gospel. You've been a steward of God's gospel. You better be careful with it. That's your job. They must be found trustworthy, meaning that they are worthy of the master's trust. How do we measure their worthiness? By numbers in the pew? Do we measure their worthiness by their eloquence? No. Do they follow the master's orders? Do they manage the master's house according to his orders? Even when he is away, do they live and serve for his glory? Verse 3, but with me, it's a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. Isn't that interesting? When we first read through that without the exposition, that seems very harsh and a little bit out of place. But as we understand this idea of galley slaves, and we understand this idea of stewards of the house, we understand what he's been telling them is I serve God. I listen for his drumbeat. I'm waiting for his direction. He's given me very clear instructions as to how I'm to present myself. If I mess up, I'm not going to be a steward anymore. If I get out of sync with the drumbeat, I'm not going to be a rower anymore. It matters little what you think. It matters everything what he thinks. How you evaluate us, one great, one better, one more, one less. It doesn't make sense because as a Christ galley slave, I serve one purpose, Christ's. As God's steward, it's only my master's directions that matter to me. And verse 4, he says, I don't even judge myself. I'm not aware of anything against myself, but I'm not thereby acquitted. It's the Lord who judges me. Do you see what he's saying there? He says, I'm not aware of anything against myself, but I'm not working for me. It's Christ who's going to evaluate my rowing. It's God who's going to evaluate my stewardship. He isn't saying that he's perfect. He isn't saying that even he doesn't get into this whole idea of himself. It's easy for us to do as pastors. Trust me, we self-evaluate frequently. One of the things that keeps us up at night and it worries us. I love this. This is an encouragement for me. He's saying that even he doesn't presume to take the position of God. For only God knows the full motives and intents of my heart. Because if I do the evaluation myself, what's going to happen? I'm either going to be too tough on myself. And I will be discouraged all the time. Or I'm going to be too easy on myself. And I'm going to miss the mark. So it's not good that we judge ourselves. We leave the judgment to God. We leave the evaluation to him. And then he comes to verse 5. Therefore, do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart. Then each one will receive his commendation from God. There's a day coming When Christ returns, the good stuff is going to be rewarded. The bad stuff is going to get burnt up. All of our motives, all of our affections are going to be evaluated by Him. But that day is not this day, is what he's saying to those Corinthians. And you are not God. God will be the judge, not you. So stop evaluating, stop criticizing, stop taking sides, stop fighting. That's the message. Before we go any further in this lesson, I put a few notes here on the side, because as we go through this, this is hard, isn't it? This kind of breaks some of our ideas. And so I wanted to stop and put context of what Paul's saying here. First, when Paul is speaking of servants being nothing, it's in relationship to God that they are nothing. The Corinthians had been building them up, one against another. So Paul wants to change their perspective, and he wants them to see them in contrast to God, who is everything. They are nothing. He's not saying that the servants of Christ are of no account. What he's saying is, don't make gods of them. Don't worship them. Don't cross that line. Who is our prime example of this idea of this servanthood? Turn to Mark chapter 10. Verse 42. And Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Do you see our example? He's that servant that we are to follow. He didn't come with chariots, with might, with power. He came quietly, he came humbly, he came to serve. So never think that this is that he wants them to devaluate these servants of Christ to a level that they're kind of like underneath their feet. He wants them to bring them down to follow the example of Christ. Second, when Paul speaks of this Corinthian judgment against them, this criticism and praise to be a very small thing, it's in light of the fact that these servants of God are there to serve the Lord and not people. He doesn't want his servants of Christ to be people pleasers. He wants them to be always focused on him. But he's not saying that they're above reproach. He's not saying that they're unable to be judged. If one of God's servants is in sin, by all means, they should be called out and dealt with. But here, that's not what he's talking about. It's not sin. What he's dealing with is the Corinthians' arrogant boasting, their critical hearts, their worldly evaluations of style and structure of these men. Third, although servants of God are likened to field hands, day laborers, lower oarsmen, galley slaves, house steward servants, Paul wants to get these Corinthians to see how crazy their quarreling was, pitting one servant against another. But it's not at all intended to diminish the church's trust or submission to each of God's servants that have been given to them. He'll deal with this later in the chapter and later in the letter. Paul also writes later in 1 Thessalonians 5, 12 to 13, he says, "We ask you, brothers, to respect those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord, and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Be at peace among yourselves." You see, what Paul's big issue isn't that he wants them to think poorly of the servants. He wants them to not think so highly of them, so highly that it divides, so highly that it causes fights and arguments. He says, "You're not going to come together. You're not going to mature until you surrender your worldly natures. You've got to stop judging by man's standards. You've got to stop looking at popularity. You've got to stop looking at style. You've got to stop looking at numbers. You've got to start looking to the Lord. This worldly trait of hero worship, where does it come from? It comes from pride. It comes from our arrogance. Look at Acts. Acts gives us a picture in Acts chapter 14. Acts 14, verse 8. Now at Lystra, there was a man sitting who could not use his feet. He was crippled from birth and had never walked. He listened to Paul speaking, and Paul, looking intently at him and seeing that he had faith to be made well, said in a loud voice, "Stand upright on your feet." He sprang up and he began walking. And when the crowd saw what Paul had done, they lifted up their voices, saying in Lyconian, "The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men." Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. And the priest of Zeus, whose temple was at the entrance to the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates, and he wanted to offer sacrifices with the crowds. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of it, they tore their garments and they rushed out into the crowd, crying out, "Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men of like nature with you, and we bring good news that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. In past generations, he allowed all the nations to walk in their own ways. But he did not leave himself without witness, for he did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness." And look at this. "But even with these words, they scarcely restrained the people from offering sacrifice to them." See what the world does? They love hero worship. They love to get behind someone. They love to place their love on someone. It makes them feel like they're a part of that victory, a part of that work. Worldly man loves to worship men. Paul isn't having any of that at Lystra or at Corinth. And finally, the last thing that we're going to look at this morning is verse 6. "I've applied all these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit, brothers, that you may learn by us not to go beyond what is written, that none of you may be puffed up in favor of one against another." Paul applied all these things. What are the things that he applied? Nothing to God's everything. Planters and waterers versus God's field. Builders and laborers, but God's building. Lower rower galley slaves for Christ. House stewards for God's gospel. And he says, "I applied all these things to myself and Apollos." What's he saying? He made sure that he and Apollos were on the exact same sheet of music. He taught this to himself, and he taught this to Apollos. He made sure that Apollos and he were very clear what their roles were. Why? For your benefit. He says, "We did this for you. We made sure that we didn't have any of this against each other." Do you understand how hard it is to stay humble when you're serving the Lord? It's so very, very difficult. Each of you, as you've worked for the Lord, I don't care if it's been having a Saturday outreach or doing any kind of work, the Lord comes in a marvelous way. People get saved. People are ministered to. And the praise starts to flow. Isn't it wonderful? Isn't it awesome? Isn't it tremendous? And we usually do a really good job of saying, "It's the Lord. The Lord takes the weak and he makes big, and it's him, it's his work." But we struggle, don't we? "I did a really good job with that. I planned that one really, really well." And then we go in and we see someone else doing a similar work, and we sit there going, "I could have done that work better than him. I wonder why God didn't have me go do that, because I could have done that 10 times better." Don't we? And we sit there in this critical state watching others going, and we lose the worship. I got to the point about 5 years ago, I couldn't worship in another church. The music would start, and I'd see something I didn't like, a dress that was too high, a drum that was too loud, and I would just go, oh, the sermon's going to be horrible. These are people that don't really love the Lord. These are people that aren't serious about their faith. And you know what? From that point forward, all I saw was bad. And trust me, there was lots of bad to find. You've all been there. And that day that you were supposed to come and give worship turned into a day where you sat in the pew and criticized. You sat in the pew and made evaluation. It was a day that you sat in the pew and raised yourself up as you tore them down. We got to be so careful of that. And I'm not saying when you go into a church that's preaching false that you don't walk out. Walk out. Don't stay and complain. What I'm saying is be careful. I put a note here on the side because some of you were around 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago. This church experienced what the Corinthian church had. There was a group that was, I am of Cecil. And there was a group that, I am of Rob. And there was a group that was, I am of Keith. Or actually, they were more of a group, I am not of Cecil. But there were three groups. And when I would preach, my group would come up and go, oh, that was so wonderful. That was so great. Oh, you have such a way of opening up the words. And oh, if only he could do that. And I was like, stop. But as you're driving home, what happens in your own mind? I did preach really good, and you know, and it was different than his style. And his group would sit there going, why do you ever let Rob take the pulpit? Why do you let him teach? He doesn't have the doctrines, he doesn't have the foundations. Why do you let him go up there? And I know he shared with me. He's like, sometimes he's thinking, well, yeah, he went a little far on that one. I wouldn't have gone there. And we started to see, for those of you that were here, do you remember the elders meetings that we would have? Because some of the elders were in one of those camps, and the people knew, and so they would pull elders into those camps. And on a Sunday morning, you'd see people, and you'd start to see segregation. And down at the coffee, you'd see segregation. And then we'd have an annual meeting, and all it was tents. Do you remember how tense the meetings were? It depended who brought forward something, whether or not it passed without a fight. And Pastor Cecil took me aside. And we prayed together. And this is what he told me. He says, don't listen to the praise. It's from men. You can't trust it. He says, when someone says you've done a good job, you know, Thais reminded me last week about the sermon that says when one of the congregants came up to the pastor who had delivered a really great sermon. They said, oh, that was a great sermon, Pastor. You know what his response was? I know. The devil told me that before I left the pulpit. Pastor shared that with me several times, but he says, it's like perfume. Don't drink it in. Take a whiff and then go on. It's fleeting. And then he says, Rob, don't take the criticism either. The criticism is from men. The same way the praise is. And when we get caught up listening to the praise and listening to the criticism, we start changing the way we teach. We start changing the way we preach. We start changing the way we act in order to silence the criticism, to enhance the praise. He says, at that point, we're out of sync. And you and I get out of sync. You and I have very different roles in this church. And he and I became to realize that the Lord had given us a very unique complementary position. And once we started seeing that the Lord had given me certain gifts and strengths and definite weaknesses, we started seeing his, and we started to see how they fit together. And we started to rejoice in the Lord at how he used those two things together for the good of the congregation. And over time, think 5 years, 4 years, 3 years ago, how we saw unity happened in this church, and we started to see the people loving one another, because every time someone would come up and say something, we would stop it dead in its tracks. We're men. We're always at risk of falling. But it's not just the men up here. Each of you as servants are in the same position. You're going to start working for the Lord, and he's going to do miraculous things. Some of you are teaching Sunday school. You're going to see kids change before your eyes. because our God is at work here. Thank God you're there. He's using you, but the change is His. The growth is His. The mercy, the grace is His. Galley slaves and house stewards. He says in verse 6 that you may learn by us not to go beyond what is written. Why? Because God desires the church to be grateful, thankful, loving to His servants. 1 Timothy 5:17 says there's a proper honor and respect, even for faithful workers, a double honor for those who work hard at preaching and teaching. But be careful about crossing the line. I am going to take you there. I was thinking, wow, I'm taking a lot of scriptures. I'm going to take you to one more. Last scripture I'm going to take you, Numbers chapter 11. Numbers chapter 11. Just doesn't happen here in Redondo Beach. It just doesn't happen in Corinth. Chapter 11, verse 24. So Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord, and he gathered 70 men of the elders of the people and placed them around the tent. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke to him and took some of the spirit that was on him and put it on the 70 elders. And as soon as the spirit rested on them, they prophesied, but they did not continue doing it. Now two men remained in the camp, one named Eldad and the other named Medad, and the spirit rested on them. They were among those that were registered, but they had not gone out to the tent. And so they prophesied in the camp. And a young man, there's always a young man, and a young man ran and told Moses, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. And look at Joshua's response. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the assistant of Moses from his youth, he said, my Lord Moses, stop them. And Moses said to him, are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that the Lord would put his spirit on them all. That's what it says in Hebrew. And Moses and the elders of Israel returned to the camp. Do you see that no one's immune? Even Joshua with Moses, he loved Moses. Stop them. They're getting credit. You should be there. This should be you. And Moses says, stop. I wish everyone was out there. I wish everyone had the spirit. I wish everyone had that zeal. Gratitude, love for those God gives to the church. Honor and respect for God's servants, but it should never go beyond that. When pride and conceit and arrogance and misplaced loyalty enter the church of Christ suffers. Divisions, quarrels develop, and what God gave to the church as a gift, Satan uses as a tool to destroy it. At the end of verse 6, he says, so that none of you may be puffed up in favor of one against the other. I talked to Apollos to make sure that he and I both understand that we are galley slaves together. None of us is greater than the other. We each have a role to do. We're all working for the same master. We're all serving the same purpose. We're all moving to the same goal. We're all bringing in the same kingdom. We're all waiting for the same Christ. I made sure that Apollos and I are in sync and that we are humble and that we know our place so that you can watch us and learn. Because the problem is you have pride. You have arrogance. You've been puffed up. And that's where we're going to pick up next week.